Blog Talk Radio.
Pour yourself a cup of tea, put your feet up, and relax. Show host Randy Fine, narcissistic abuse expert, compassionate counselor for clients worldwide, and author of the groundbreaking new book, Close Encounters of the Worst Kind, invites you into her sanctuary, a place where your emotional, physical, and spiritual well-being are all that matters. Time to Heal is a fundraising single written and performed by Johnny Z for the Amy Winehouse Foundation. For more information, please go to johnnymusic.com, johnnymusic.com. And now, it's time to meet Randy, show host of the podcast enjoyed by fans around the globe, A Fine Time for Healing.
Good morning. Thank you for tuning in to listen to A Fine Time for Healing. I am your radio show host, Randy Fine, and today I am so excited to welcome back Dr. Chris Quartman, co-author of the book Keep Pain in the Past, Getting Over Trauma, Grief, and the Worst That's Ever Happened to You. This is a book that will teach you the critical 21st century skill of treating your own psychological wounds, help you confront the emotional baggage of your past, reach closure by completing the event, and finally discover a life unhaunted by past trauma. Chris Quartman, PsyD, has been a licensed psychologist for 28 years. He is a much sought-after speaker, has facilitated more than 60,000 hours of psychotherapy, and has provided psychological consultation at 5 hospitals in the Sarasota-Venice area. Dr. Quartman is the co-creator of a youth prevention and wellness program called the Social Black Belt. We had such a great conversation last time, and it just wasn't enough. So he's back to talk with us again. And so let me introduce you and bring him on. Good morning, Dr. Quartman.
Good morning, Randy. Thank you so much for having me back and those kind words.
Oh, you're welcome. It's yes, you are very welcome. I'm excited to have you back. We talked about many, many things from your book last time, and there's more that I wanted to ask you. But before we went on air, we sort of got into a conversation that we weren't able to really complete. So I wanted to start with that. Since I have so many listeners who are suffering from narcissistic abuse, who are survivors and are trying to heal this, I wanted to know what your experience is with narcissistic abuse.
Well, you know, when we use the term narcissism, you know, we're talking about the type of person who does not have a great deal of sympathy or empathy or regard for others. A narcissistic person, by definition, likes things to be about them, and they quickly lose interest in any kind of situation that does not shine positively on them. And remarkably, there's even a lack of investment in the lives sometimes of their children, because it takes the focus off of them, and they're not particularly thrilled when that when that limelight should shine elsewhere. However, there are some who transfer their narcissism onto the children, and in effect, what they're doing is they're living vicariously through the children because it's about them. This is now mini-me, and I'm using my child again to meet my own needs. Perhaps the career I wanted but didn't quite have, I'm going to emphasize in my child's life, whether or not they have any interest in going in that direction or whether they share the same kind of passion for that particular career or line of work or interest or sport. I want the child to pursue that to fulfill my own needs. And so those are two different types of narcissism, and either way, it could leave a lot of bad taste and a lot of symptoms with the survivors and such. And, you know, it becomes a necessity for children who grew up in such a family with that type of a parent. It becomes necessary for them to clean up the mess that was made in their lives because they realize that I never felt like I had any worth. And the only time that I had any real kudos is when I was doing exactly what my parents wanted me to do or my parent wanted me to do to bring them pleasure or notoriety or fame or attention or whatever it is. And I, in and of myself, there was no real interest. There was no real concern. There was no desire to get to know me. There
right.
was no sense that I was a separate person. It's only how I was connected to the narcissistic parent that mattered to that person.
Yes, absolutely. Do you have you seen many patients who are victims of this abuse or survivors of this abuse?
Well, sure. And it's not an unusual thing in our society. And it's even
no.
more common when parents are successful or famous or have some kind of a career that they're very invested or proud of. You know, the children can right away feel that they don't measure up and that they're not as interesting. And in some cases, they feel like they're a big disappointment because they didn't succeed in the same way that the, you know, narcissistic parent did. And that could lead to tremendous feelings of shame and a sense of being inadequate, not good enough, and it's sort of a toxic way to relate to the world. You know, it was written about in Eric Berne's classic back in the 70s and 80s that I'm okay, you're okay. That this was a position where I start life off with I'm not okay, and then the other possibilities are that you're not okay, or sometimes even worse, I'm not okay, but you are, where the parent who's narcissistic is okay, but I'm not. And so many other people are okay, but I'm not. So I face my life feeling always as if I'm inadequate, that I have deficits that can never be satisfied, that if anyone really gets to know me, then they're going to find me woefully inept. And so I may even look for ways to sabotage good opportunities in my personal life as well as in my career because I don't feel worthy of having love because I don't know what it tastes like. And I don't know what it feels like to really be loved for the person that I am.
You are so right. What I find is children who have been abused in their families often don't know that they have been. I mean, this was the case with me, until really they kind of wake up between around 45 and 55, and all of a sudden the relationships that they have tolerated that have made them feel uncomfortable but they didn't know why, all of a sudden they cannot tolerate them anymore, and they begin seeking and answers. And when, you know, when it is NPD, and they can identify it, it is such a relief for people. So, I just wanted, to say that to my listeners, that it's not always easy to recognize, especially if your abuser is a covert abuser, because everything is done under the radar, and you can never put your finger on it, right?
Exactly. It doesn't have the marks, bruises, broken bones as other kinds of abuse. You know, it doesn't have the traumatic weight, say, that sexual abuse has, or the take your parents away from you abuse of physical abuse. Those things carry much more credibility, if you will. And yet, when you have been abused in this way, even though it takes a while to really put the pieces together and figure out the marks, the results, the consequences can be every bit as severe.
Right, absolutely right. I wanted to talk about some of the techniques that you use with your patients and you teach them to use. And one of them I thought was really interesting, you talk about in the book, the guided imagery. I'm familiar with guided imagery because I go onto YouTube and I listen to these guided imagery meditations sometimes, and sometimes recommend them. But how do you use guided imagery with your patients?
You know, thank you for asking that. It's a topic that I love to talk about, because even at this point in my career, I continue to be fascinated and amazed by its incredible power every single time I use it. And, you know, I can think of a time using it this past week with a gentleman who whose son died about 15 years ago, and he has been trying to be a fill-in father for his granddaughter. And, you know, that led us to some discussion about how challenging it was. And one of the questions I asked him is, have you had a chance to say goodbye to your son and make peace with his death? And he said, no, I've never even thought like that. So I described for him a technique that I use so often called guided imagery. And what guided imagery is a chance to close your eyes and relax, and then imagine in your mind's eye whatever it is you need to see in order to gain some type of closure or peace, release about something that's unfinished in your life. And so he was very interested, because I had a chance to share with him, you know, a couple of other stories from recently about how effective. And so he trusted me with that. And we went somewhere that he and his son both enjoyed and could talk. And as long as the mind's eye sees this, it works as a trick on the nervous system that it becomes real. And the reactions that one has emotionally are consistent with what they would have felt had this been a real occurrence. In fact, it's quite analogous to a dream. As we all know, dreams are movies that we wrote, directed, and starred in. They're not real, but they can be so incredibly powerful that you can wake up from a dream and wonder, did that really happen? Or you can wake up from a dream and be in terror, or you could wake up amused about something that happened, or excited, or, you know, whatever the emotion was, you can have it be real to you because the dream, although just a movie, became so real in your nervous system. So a guided imagery works much like that. So what I emphasize is the guided part, which is I want to have a really good outcome where we put away something that's been tormenting a person, a trauma, a rape, an accident, or finally make peace with a relationship that has been tormented, or the person has been tormented in their mind ever since abuse or ever since death or something that has never been quite finished. So back to this gentleman. This was a little more than a week ago. We did the procedure, and we just had a chance for him to say everything he wanted to say to his late son and hear whatever he needed to hear in return from the deceased. And I always speak for the deceased, and I'll say things like, I'm only allowed to meet with you one time. I can tell you that I'm very well where I am. I'm not allowed to tell you much about it, except I'm at peace here and it's beautiful. And I'd like to think that someday you'll be with me. And that's only if it's consistent with the person's spiritual faith or religion. You know, if they don't believe in anything beyond this, I certainly respect that and will not shove that way of thinking down their throats. But in this case, he had a chance to say what he needed to and to hear what he needed to. And he said it was very powerful. And, you know, I sent him on his way. Well, I always look for the following session and to see what was the impact right away. And I asked them to write about it for me so I know exactly what took place in their mind. And he wrote about it, and he said, I asked him what kind of an impact he had. He said it was something like it was monumental. That's the word he used. It was I said, you know, monumental is quite a description. That's a big word. That means that it really transformed something. Tell me about what was monumental. He says, I don't take my word back. Let me explain how monumental it was. Not only did I feel finally a sense of peace about my son, but I went to sleep that night. And about 2 o'clock in the morning, I felt this sense of peace go through my entire body. And it was like a continuation of the imagery where I finally had a sense that anything that had ever happened between me and my son was finally laid to rest. And there's nothing but peace about him for the first time in my life since he's been gone. And then he said, secondly, I felt the sense that this is exactly what I needed to do in regard to my parents. He said they fought so much when I was a child that I grew up with anxiety and always looking to be a peacemaker. But I never dealt with the issues and the feelings of what it was like to have my parents in conflict all the time. He said this very week I did another quick imagery myself to get some peace about that. And I finally feel much more peace about what happened with my parents, even though that's not the imagery we did. And so he was kind of gushing about, I want to be able to do this for everything in my life because I want to be at peace with anything and everything that's ever happened to me.
That is so powerful. Oh, I'm sure you love hearing that. So we can do it without somebody actually speaking for the other person. We can. How would we do that if we didn't have you to help us through it?
Well, you know, it's more about what is it that you need to hear. And, you know, I'm thinking of someone who came in and had so much guilt because his son died of an overdose of drugs, and 2 years after his physician sent he and his wife in for grief counseling, he came back by himself, and he said, Doc, I can't get past the guilt. I feel so much guilt. And I said, well, what is this guilt about? And he said, I didn't save my son. I said, okay, well, what did you do? He said, well, that's just it. I put him in rehab 2 or 3 times. I gave him money. I talked to him every day. I was his best friend. I was his confidant. I said, I tried tough love. I don't know what else I could have done. And I said to him, with all due respect, sir, your problem is not guilt. He said, it's not. I said, no, your problem is you don't want to say goodbye to your son. And as long as you stay guilty, it's your way of protesting your son's death. It's like an adult temper tantrum. I'm not accepting his death. He should never have died. And I'm going to stay guilty. This was the time I asked for permission to do an imagery and talk, you know, and meet with the son. But this man really, he really threw a nice curveball at me, because after the imagery, he said, that was so amazing. He said, I met my son on a place called Rainbow Bridge. And he said, I don't know if you've ever heard of Rainbow Bridge, but Rainbow Bridge is where dogs go to die. And he said, I've had two of my dogs die, and I put my son on Rainbow Bridge. And I said, you're in charge of those dogs until I get there someday. And I spoke for the son, and I said something that he really needed to hear, which was, Dad, stop blaming yourself for my death. The reason I died is because I didn't want to stop using drugs. I liked how they made me feel, and I didn't like how hard it was to deal with life without them. It wasn't your fault. You were my best pal. You were the guy I could turn to about anything. I'm the reason why my life didn't continue. And my patient was able to put that away on that day. And whatever else we dealt with for the rest of his life, he was able to say, you know, ever since we did that thing, I've been at peace with Matthew. And the thing would mean the guided imagery. But, what was so powerful for him was two things, I think. Number one, having his son say to him that, you know, Dad, this wasn't your deficit. This was me. I had free will, and I continued to choose to use drugs. And secondly, that he could put his son in a place where he was okay, he was at peace, and then there was the hope that someday, you know, I'm going to join you and the dogs again.
That is such a great story. I love that. I love that. Wow. And for anybody who doesn't know what the Rainbow Bridge is, look it up, because there's a beautiful poem that's been written about it, and it's where our pets go and where they're waiting for us when we cross over. That's just an amazingly beautiful story. I love it. And I can understand why that was so powerful. Now, if you weren't there to say what you said, would it have been as effective?
You know, I don't think it would have, unless he did for himself what he needed to do. And that's, you know, you're asking this really good question. What if I'm not there? And here's something that I would recommend, and this is brand new. This is me responding to a really great question, which is, write down for yourself what you need from your imagery, and then make sure you get that. So if what we need from someone is an apology, then make sure you hear that apology. If what you need from someone is their forgiveness from you, when you say, I'm so sorry, I was not the parent for you that I could have been because I was drinking back during those days. And what you most need is some kind of absolution. You know, in the imagery, have your late child or whoever it is say to you, I'm okay and I forgive you. Or whatever it is you need, you have to supply that, because, again, once the mind's eye sees it and the mind embraces it and believes it, there's much more power in belief than there is in reality. We all know that. What we perceive is more important than reality.
You're right.
So I'm talking to a woman. You know, you asked a great question, and so it inspires all these other things.
Oh,
so here's a
good
story about a woman who was raped in her 20s. And I'm doing an imagery with her so she can confront the rapist who is in real life in prison. And while I'm talking on his behalf, she opens up her eyes very quickly and she says, I want him to apologize to me. So she was really clear that this guy needed to say he was sorry for what he did to her. And I, of course, incorporated that into my speaking. And you know, the good news, you know, I wouldn't have to tell a story like this, except that it only took a one-time imagery, and she's done. She's done with the rape. And she had so many things that we had to do. One of those was one summer where she was molested by her grandfather because her parents left her there for the summer when they went overseas. And where's the safest place, you know, to leave our six-year-old daughter? Of course, with mom and dad. Well, guess what? It was the worst place because she was molested that summer. But anyway, we got through that. We got through the rape, and then she took me to these other unfinished things in her life. When she was bullied for a couple of years in school, she said she moved to meet a fiance. She changed her life, moved to Boston. As soon as she got there, he said, "I got bad news. I don't want to do this." You know, so we had to go through every unfinished thing in her life. And then guess what? She got sober. And she's been sober today for 4 years, but only because we cleaned up these other unfinished messes, including the molestation, including the rape, etc. So my point is, the alcohol all these years were, you know, was keeping her buoyant because she could not face the things that were traumatic for her. Now we have all this new research coming out that says we once thought that addiction and alcoholism and these things were really so much about genetics, and now we're saying, wait a minute, it's more about trauma than anything. The former president of the American Psychiatric Association had a great little line. He said, let me put it to you this way, smoking is the cancer as trauma is to addiction. Now we have research that says at least 2 out of 3 female alcoholics were molested as children. I mean, we now know that people are using a lot of the drugs they're using in an effort to keep them away from what it is they haven't yet dealt with, and that's the, you know, the unfinished traumas from our lives. If you haven't figured it out, if you live 80, 85 years on this planet, there are so many losses. You're going to lose thousands of things and people along the way, and it's a very painful ride. Even if it's a successful ride, even if it's a happy ride, you're going to lose so many things and people that matter to you that it's very painful and often traumatic. And the way people stay healthy is by being able to face their traumas and their losses and grieve them successfully and say goodbye. We have to, you know, it's like love, lose, grieve, and then love, lose, grieve. It's like continue throughout our lives. We have to keep on losing that which we love, and then we have to grieve and say goodbye. You know, you got this fantastic dog, and then Muffin dies on you, and you should take Muffin in the backyard, and you should have a ceremony and bury Muffin, and everybody should say how much Muffin meant and release him, and then 3 months later, you got to bring home Sparky because life goes on, and we need to love again, and then we're going to lose Sparky at some point, and we keep on doing that. Because this life is chock full of loss and pain, and those who do it well have to learn how to grieve and have to learn how to release and have to learn how to love again, or else they become hardened and embittered and broken and depressed and addicted and so forth.
Wow, you've packed so much wonderful, amazing information into that, into what you just said. There's so many things that hit a nerve with me, you know, just so many things that made sense. And thank you for sharing those stories, because they are illustrative of, you know, of some real situations that people do go through. In the beginning, you were saying that that when the father first came to you, that you said it wasn't about guilt, it was about lack of acceptance of the death of his son.
Yes.
So are we talking about false guilt here? You know, when you take responsibility for events that are beyond your control, is that what we call false guilt?
You know what? It is. It is false guilt. And, you know, I learned it. This is part of the on-the-job training part of being a psychologist. I learned it many, many years ago, probably my first year of practice, when a woman told me how guilty she was that her husband died. And I said, you know, essentially the same thing. Tell me about your guilt and what you did and didn't do. And then she told me, well, I took him to the Mayo Clinic, and I took him to this expert and that expert, and I stayed home with him for years. And I'm listening and going, and so tell me what you could have done differently. And that's when she said, I don't know what I could have done differently. It's like, no, this is not about guilt. This is about your husband died on your watch, and it's completely unacceptable to you. You don't want to say goodbye to him. And as long as you blame yourself, you don't have to say goodbye to him. You can keep on holding on to this ridiculous guilt because you couldn't have done better. I'm blown away by what you did as a wife. I hope someone would take care of me like that someday if I have these issues. But
really? You're not, of course.
You know, but you're not guilty. What you are is protesting. You want your husband back. It's not fair to you. It's not right that he should be gone when you did all the things you did. You know, it just remind me, these stories always kind of connect, but I was talking to a group once called Compassionate Friends. And by definition, the only way you could get in this group is if you lost a child to death. And so I walk in as the guest speaker, and they start by going around the room with everybody telling what happened to their child. And it was like the saddest room you could ever be in. You just heard like 24 straight stories of people who lost a child to death. And I felt like, so where's the closest exit where I can sneak out of this room and don't? But instead it was like, okay, make these people feel better. And there's a daunting task for you. So I told them this one story about the gentleman with the guilt and his son and Rainbow Bridge and all of that. And the group was really amazingly positive and just said the kindest things. And then a week later, I got a card in the mail from a woman who said, "Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk to us. I want you to know the story you told about the guilty father resonated with me. Let me tell you mine," she said. "My son died in my apartment on my watch. He overdosed to death, and I have been feeling guilty ever since. But after hearing your story, I realize I'm keeping the guilt so I don't have to say goodbye to him and accept that he's not coming back. As long as I stay guilty, I don't have to release him," she said, and I love this part. "I'm not ready to do it today, but I know there's going to be a time in the future where I'm going to have to say goodbye to my son."
Just talking about this today, I know it's helping so many people. This is so important for us to hear. Because as you said, we will grieve over and over in our lifetime. This is a really tough place to be. You know, there's a lot of joy, but it's hard work here. So any tools that we can have for living and just, what's the word I'm trying to think of? Not living, but, yeah, in a really good way. I can't think of the word.
Think I hear what you're asking, and I appreciate your questions. They're always questions that inspire me to think and to recognize that the audience is full of people who are hurting about something, because you can't go through this journey without hurting about many things along the way, especially if you're a caring person. And so when you ask about tools, I guess I want people to understand that their joy and their sorrow are part of the very same process, and they're often flip sides of the same coin, such that you will have no joy without investment, and you will have no sorrow without investment. So if you want to be really free of sorrow in this lifetime, don't invest in anything. Don't care about people. Don't get involved in activities. Do not bring home pets and love them. Definitely don't procreate, because children have a way of working themselves into your heart. So don't do that. No significant others. Whatever you do, don't do that, because that leads to love and that makes you vulnerable. So the best way to go through life without those kinds of sorrows is to have no investment. Oh, by the way, you won't have any joy either. That's a considerable loss. I like thinking of sports fans. The word fan comes from the word fanatic. And when you are a fanatic about some team, you kind of live and die with that team. And there's incredible joy when your football team wins on a Sunday or wins the championship or Super Bowl or whatever it is. But there's also great sorrow and loss and disappointment and anger and frustration and woulda, coulda, shoulda. And there's all of that, unless you don't care. You can see the three kinds of people at Super Bowl parties. You can see the ones who are passionately rooting for the American Football Conference champion, and you can see the people who are passionately rooting for the National Football Conference champion, and then the third group who are there for the commercials and the social gathering tips. And no matter what, on the TV,
right,
there's no passion because there's no investment. You have to be invested. And so I would say to people, you really want some good advice, it wouldn't be don't invest in anything. It would be invest. But understand that with every investment, there's the potential to lose and therefore the need to grieve. So if there's one thing we should be teaching our children, it's how to grieve and say goodbye from an early age. Because I'll tell these kids, and we do in my program, my social black belt program, we'll tell them, you're going to have thousands of losses along the way. I hate to be the one to tell you this, but your grandparents, as much as they adore you, they're going to die, and you have to say goodbye to them. And your favorite musician and your favorite rock star, I mean, they're not going to be stars for very long. And, you know, your favorite TV show is going to go off the air, and your friends, oh, by the way, they're going to move to other places. And look around this first grade class. If you're even face-to-face in touch with one person in 20 years, 20 years from now, that'll be a lot. Because we lose, lose, lose. I'm not even going to tell you about the best friend who's going to say bad things about you, or the girlfriend who's going to decide she's tired of you and want to go with your best friend, or, you know, losses. So what do we do with all these losses? We have to learn to grieve. We have to learn to cry. We have to learn to say goodbye. We have to learn to let go. There's no more important tool in all of healing than letting go. Letting go, by the way, is the best definition that there is for forgiveness in my book. And forgiveness, you know, all the major religions in the world are about love. And because of love, love is made manifest in forgiveness, which is letting go. So people are going to hurt you, and what do you do with that? Do you gain revenge? Hopefully not. Hopefully you let go and you move on. Because learning to grieve, learning to let go is possibly the most important skill there is in a human lifetime. And because I see people do it so well, and because I see people heal, it makes me want to come back and sit in my chair. You know, you read something that's probably a little bit old now. I'm in my 33rd year of private practice. I've exceeded 70,000 hours of therapies, and I've heard so much pain and so much horror and so much betrayal and abandonment and abuse and neglect and everything a person could do to another person. And yet I keep coming back to sit in my chair, not to hear those stories, but because of the healing. And the healing comes when people are brave enough to face what happened to them, remember it, feel the feelings, express and release the feelings, and then put another frame on it. Letting go and realizing that whatever happened to me, I can learn from, I can grow from, I could possibly make the world a better place because of that. If you don't mind, I have a story for that, if you have the time right now.
About a minute. Can you tell it in about a minute?
I will.
Okay.
A woman thinks she's going to sleep as normal that night, but there's a man in a mask with a knife in her apartment, and he brutally hurts her, cuts her, leaves her for dead, 14 cuts in her body. She survives. He goes to prison. Turns out he was the guy she was dating. Anyway, she had to put her life back together, and we did one of these imageries to finish that horror, which was the turning point in her therapy. Now, here's the reason I'm bringing up the story. Because instead of staying stuck in being a victim, because her story is as bad as they come, she decided, I'm going to do something positive. So she goes into schools with police officers and helps girls who have difficult things. She not only finished her trauma, but she put a different frame on it and used it as a way to help others.
Yeah, you know, and in your book, that was one of the things that I read about a lot, is reframing the trauma
right.
in a way that makes it, finding something in there that makes it not worthwhile, but just finding the silver lining, because there's always one that you can find. So I wanted to ask you, before we run out of time, do you do counseling by Skype or whatever, or do you just do it in your chair, in your office?
Another good question. I can and have done Skype. I can and do telephonic therapy. I have clients right now in California who definitely don't want to start all over again since they started here. So we just keep doing what we're doing, but they're in L.A.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's possible. It's possible to do anything that works, anything that makes sense.
Okay. So you're in Venice, Florida. So for my listeners, if you're in Venice, Florida, well, then Dr. Chris Kortman is right there for you. If not, what is your website that they can find you on?
They could just look up my name. I think it's SRQ Shrink, but if you just look up my name, it'll take you to the website.
Okay, SRQ Shrink. Yeah, that's your email address.
Yeah,
okay.
SRQ stands for Sarasota. Like LAX is Los Angeles, SRQ is Sarasota. So it's
okay.
SRQ Shrink.
Okay, perfect. Oh, this has gone way too fast, but it's been great talking to you. Thank you so much again for being my guest. It's, you know, you just have such wisdom to offer us, and it makes so much sense, and it's not hard. You know, people say to me, "What kind of work do I have to do to heal?" And I'm like, "It shouldn't be work. You know, it doesn't have to be work. You've worked your whole life. You've been suffering. This should be easy." And I like that what you offer is easy. It's an easy way to overcome this.
It really works. The hardest part is dealing with the feelings. Whatever it is over. It's already finished. It's already happened. Now what I have to do is to feel, express, and release my emotions and accept what happened. And when I do that, then I can not only have peace about it, but I can be empowered to do good things going forward. You know, my mother came up with something one day that really was impressive to me. She didn't realize it when she said it. She said, "You know, I think I stay sad to keep Rosie alive." Rosie was her late sister. And I said, what a brilliant quip without realizing it. You know, behavior is purposeful, and I can stay sad as a way to keep somebody here. So I never have to say goodbye to them. I can just stay sad.
Wow. Well, see, she was a therapist in making, but I don't know if she ever if she ever went forward with it. But anyway, I have to say goodbye. I have to say goodbye. Thank you again.
Goodbye is good.
Or see ya, right?
Thank you for the opportunity.
Okay, all right. Be well. Take care. Thank you again. Okay.
Bye-bye.
So our show is over for today, but may joy and serenity always be yours. Goodbye.